Welcome to the Sagebrush Trail. Stories of the West. From the frontier to the Yukon. I'm Mardell, reading Crossing the Plains, Days of 57 by William Audley Maxwell. Chapter 6. Origin of Piker. The appellation piker, much used in the West in early days, synonymous of Missourian, had its origin on these plains. At first it was applied to a particular type of Missourian, but later came to be used generally. There was among the immigrants a considerable number of persons from Pike County, Missouri. Some of these had the sign, "From Pike County, Missouri," painted on their wagon covers. Others, when asked whence they came, promptly answered, "From Pike County, Missouri, by gosh, sir," often said with a shrug implying that the speaker arrogated to himself much superiority by reason of the facts stated. The display of such signs and announcements like that just mentioned were of such frequent occurrence that the substance was soon abbreviated to piker and became a byword. It was often spoken with a tinge of odium. Possibly this was due to the fact that many of the people referred to were of a backwoods class, rather short in culture and in personal makeup, manner, and language, bearing a general air of the extremely rural. Though only persons of that description hailing from Pike County were those who at first had to bear the opprobrium generally applied by piker, later it was applied to all persons of that type in the far West, regardless of their origin. Many years of mingling of California's cosmopolitan population has changed all that, producing her present homogeneous, sterling, virile, and somewhat distinct type of Californian. So the piker, as such, is no longer in the land. A later application of the same word descriptive of a person who does business in a small way has nothing in common with the piker of early days. 58 years ago, the time of the events here narrated, was before the era of canned goods. Nearly all the foodstuffs carried by the immigrants were in crude form and bulky, but substantial, pure, and such as would keep in any climate. During the first few weeks of the trip, we milked some of the cows and also made butter, the churning operation being affected mainly by the motion of the wagons in the regular course. That this did not last long was due to the reduction of milk supply. After a time, there was not sufficient even for use in the coffee or for making gravy, that convenient substitute for butter. Such delicacies as may now be found in first-class canned meats, vegetables, and milk would have filled an often felt want. The occasional supply that we had en route of fresh meat and fish were obtained largely by chance, we having no knowledge of localities where hunting and fishing were likely to be successful. And it being deemed unsafe for members of the party to wander far or remain long away from the train, it seems regrettable that the invention of hermetically sealed and easily portable foods and the inducement to cross the plains to California did not occur in reverse sequence. Neither had the Kodak arrived. Had it been with us then, this narrative might be illustrated with snapshots of camp scenes, characteristic roadside views, and incidents of travel generally, which would do more for realism than can any word picture. We often see specimens of artists' work purporting to represent a 49er immigrant train on the overland journey, some of them very clever. But seldom are they at all realistic to the man who was there. The man with a camera could have perpetuated, for example, the striking scene presented to us one day of a party consisting of two men and their wives, with two or three children, sitting on a rocky hillside, woefully scanning their team of done-out oxen and one wagon with a broken axle, no means at hand for recuperation and repair, in the scorching sun of a July day they waited, utterly helpless, hopeless, forlorn, confused, and 1,000 miles from anywhere. Such a grouping would not have made a cheerful picture, but it would have assisted immensely in recording a historical fact. But no immigrant ever found another in distress and passed on by the other side. We were early risers, and the camp was each morning a scene of life with the rising of the sun. By sunset, all were sufficiently fatigued to wish for making camp again. Therefore, from the morning start till the evening stop was usually about 12 hours, with variations from time to time, according to necessity or exceptional conditions. Breaking camp in the morning became routine and proceeded like clockwork. Each patient ox voluntarily drew near and stood waiting to be yoked with his fellow and chained to his daily task. So well did each know his place by the side of his mate that the driver had only to place one end of the yoke on the neck of the off ox, known, for example, as Bright, and hold the other end toward the nigh ox, saying, "Come under here, Buck," and the obedient fellow placed himself in position. Then the bows were placed and keyed, and Bright and Buck were hitched for duty. It required but a few minutes to put 3 or 4 yoke of oxen under working order. As the result of much repetition, the packing of the camp articles onto the wagons was done dexterously and quickly. Each box, roll, and bundle had a designated place, all being arranged usually to facilitate sitting or reclining positions for those who rode in the schooners, that they might be as comfortable as possible and read, sleep, or, as the women often did, sew and knit or play games. During some parts of the trip, such means of whiling away the hours was very desirable, if not a necessity, if there ever was a time or condition in which it could be pardonable to kill time. These circumstances were there during many long days. The bivouac was always a scene of bustle and orderly disorder, especially if the campsite was a good one. Wood, water, and grass, being the desiderata, obedient to habit, every person and animal dropped into place and action. With the wagons drawn to position for the night's sojourn, teams were quickly unhitched, the yokes, chains, harness, and saddles falling to the ground where the animals stood. Relieved of their trappings, the oxen, horses, and mules returned to pasture, plentiful or scant. Cooking utensils came rattling from boxes. Rolls of bedding tumbled out and were spread on the smoothest spots of sand or grass. Eager hands gathered such fuel as was available, and the campfire blazed. Buckets of water were brought from the spring or stream, and in an incredibly short time the scene of animation had wrought full preparation for the night, while the odor of steaming coffee and frying bacon rendered the astonished air redolent of appetizing cookery. Some families used a folding table on which to serve meals, but more spread an oilcloth on the ground and gathered around that. More individuals, taking a plate and a portion, sat on a wagon tongue or a convenient stone. Camp stools and split-bottom chairs were among the luxuries that some carried in limited numbers, but these were not useful, especially as seats while partaking of a meal spread on the ground. Appetites were seldom at fault, and the meals, though plain and of little variety, were never slighted. It is hardly necessary to add that bacon and coffee were easy staples. Bread was mainly in the form of quick-fire biscuits, baked in a skillet or similar utensil, or the ever-ready and always welcome flapjack, sometimes supplemented with soda crackers, as a delicacy. Nearly all the nights were pleasant. Mild temperature, very little dew. This gave much relief, the daytime heat being generally irksome and often distressingly hot. Many of the men came to prefer sleeping wholly in the open, with the heavens unobscured, while requiring no more than a pair of blankets and a small pillow. Early evening was devoted to social gatherings. If the night was pleasant, groups would assemble for conversation, singing, and storytelling, varied with dancing by the young people of some companies, The more religious sang hymns and read the Bible sometimes, in lieu of attendance at any church service. When wood was plentiful, a bonfire added to the cheerfulness and comfort of the occasion. Often neighboring trains camped quite near, when much enjoyment was found in visits by the members of one company among those of another. In such ways, many agreeable acquaintances were met, and even lasting friendships formed, some of which have endured throughout the nearly 70 years since past. But we were not always favored with clear and pleasant weather. No one who was there can have forgotten one night at the Platte River when we had a most dismal experience. Rain began falling in the afternoon, and for that reason we made camp early. The tents were set up on a bit of flat ground near the river bank. There were some large trees, but little dry wood available for fuel for the campfire, except on an island which was separated from us by a branch of the river about 20 yards wide and a foot deep. Some of us waded over, getting our clothes soaked. Others crossed on horseback and carried back from the island enough wood to make a fire. But time after time the fire was quenched by the rain, which now was falling in torrents, so we had much difficulty in preparing our supper. The people huddled into the tents and wagons, half hungry, more than half wet, and uncomfortable altogether. With the exception of one or two cots, the bedding was spread on the ground in the tents, and all turned in, but not for long. Someone said, "Water's running under my bed." Then another and another made the same complaint. Soon we learned the deplorable fact that the large tent had been pitched in a basin-like place, and that the water, as the rain increased, was coming in from all sides, and the volume growing rapidly greater. We succeeded then in lighting one lantern, when the water was found to be something like 2 inches deep over nearly all parts of the large tent's floor. The beds were taken up and placed in soaked heaps on camp stools and boxes, and the rain continued pouring in steady, relentless disregard of our misery. Except where lighted by the single lantern, the darkness was, of course, absolute. Relief was impossible. There appearing to be nothing else to do, everybody abandoned the tents and huddled in the wagons. The lantern was blown out, and there was little sleep, while we waited and wished for daylight. Some of the days were warm and some hot. Some were very hot. Discomforts were common, and yet not much was said and apparently little thought of them, having become inured to the conditions as we found them. From time to time, discomforts, such as under other circumstances would have been considered intolerable, were passed without comment. There were times and situations in which hardships were unavoidable, some of them almost unendurable, but these, having been anticipated, were perhaps less poignant in the enduring than in the expectation. Let us for a moment raise the curtain of more than half a century, while we look back on one of those ox-drawn trains of prairie schooners, as it appeared to an observer on the ground at the time, about the middle of August and beyond the middle of the journey. Permit the imagination to place the scene alongside that of the present-day modes of traversing the same territory when the distance is covered in a less number of days than it required months then. Perhaps such a comparison may help to form some faint conception of what the overland pioneers did and what they felt and saw and were. There they are as we see them on a long stretch of sagebrush plateau. The surface of the plain is only sand and gravel, as far as the eye can reach. The atmosphere is hazy, with dust and vibrating waves of heat arising from the ground. Far away to the northwest is the outline of some mountains, just visible in the dim distance. In the opposite direction whence we have come, there is nothing above the ground but hot space and dust. Not a living thing in sight, but ourselves and ours. The animals appear fatigued, jaded. The people appear, well, as to physical condition, like the animals. Generally, all look alike. Yet the people seem hopeful. And why hopeful? The inherent and indomitable trait of the race, which makes it possible for humanity to look over and past present difficulties, however great, and see some good beyond. That is why the world do move. Often as it was with us, progress may be slow, but every day counts for a little. Just here, 12 or 15 miles a day is doing well, very well. From a slight eminence at one side of the way, we may stand and see the slowly creeping line of wagons and stock, for many miles fore and aft, as they bend their way in and out, around and over, the surface of knolls and flats, hillocks and gullies. From a distant view, they seem not to be moving at all. The hour of midday arrives, and they stop for the nooning. There is nothing growing in the vicinity that the horses and cattle can eat, and no water except the little in the keg and canteens. So the carrying animals stand in their yokes in harness or under saddles, and the loose stock wait in groups, their thirst unslaked. As the people come out of the wagons and go about the business of the hour, we see the marks of the elements upon them. The women wear poke bonnets and gingham dresses. The men are unshaven. All are sunburnt to a rich leathern brown. Some are thin, and at this particular time wear a serious expression. They are not as unhappy as they look, their principal trouble of the moment being merely anxiety to satisfy prodigious and healthy appetites. There, under the stress of the midsummer sun, now in the zenith, no shade, no protection from the flying dust, they proceed cheerfully to build a fire of sticks and dry weeds. They fry bacon and bake biscuits, prepare large pots of coffee, and they eat from tin plates and drink from tin cups. No one says this is awful. They laugh as they eat, saying, "Good, ain't it?" This is not a cheerful view altogether of the retrospective, but a sketch true to life, as life was there. It was not all like that. A good deal of it was. Some will say that these overland travelers were overzealous, even foolhardy. One of the earliest pioneers, Mr. Daniel B. Miller, who reached Oregon by the plains route in 1852, wrote later to relatives in Illinois, "I would not bring a family across for all that is contained in Oregon and California." Himself single, he had come with a train composed almost wholly of men, but learned incidentally what risks there were in escorting women and children through the wilds. But the enduring of all this toil, exposure, and hardship had for its inspiration the buoyant hope of something good just beyond, something that was believed to be worthy of the privation and effort it was costing. The ardor of that hope was too intense to be discouraged by anything that human strength could overcome. The memories of those strenuous experiences are held as all but sacred. And you never meet one of these early overland immigrants who does not like to sit by your fireside and tell you about it. He forgets for the moment how hard it was and dwells upon it, telling it over and over again with the same pride and sense of noble achievement that the old soldier feels when recounting the battles and the camp life and the hard marches of the war when he was young away back in the 60s. Once crossing this country by present-day conveyances and richly appointed railroad trains, with all the comforts obtainable in modern sleeping, dining, and parlor cars, can hardly be expected to conceive what it was to cover the same course under the conditions described, when there was not even a poor wagon road, and the utmost speed did not equal in a day the distance traveled in half an hour by the present mode. Any person who rides in a cumbrous and heavily laden wagon behind a team whose pace never exceeds a slow walk over dusty ground in hot weather will, before one day is past, feel that endurance requires utmost fortitude. Consider what patience must be his if the journey continues for 4, 5, or 6 long months. It is worthy of mention that there was no dissension among our people, nor even unpleasantness during the entire trip, nor did we observe any among others. We were fortunate in having no grouches among us. Harmony, cheerfulness, a disposition to be jolly, even to the degree of hilarity, was the prevailing spirit. That, too, under circumstances often so trying that they might have thrown a sensitive disposition out of balance. All this in the wilds of an unorganized territory, where there was no law to govern, other than the character and natural bent of individuals. Such a lack of established authority, we had thought, might lead to recklessness or aggressive conduct. But it did not. Present residents in the fields and valleys, and the prosperous towns along much of the line of travel described, will find it difficult to reconcile the accounts here given with conditions as they see them now. Leagues of territory now bearing a network of railroads and splendid highways, which carry rich harvests from the well-tilled farms and connect numerous cities, was thought of ordinarily by the immigrants in early days only as it appeared to them, and then was the stamping ground of savage tribes and the home of wild beasts, untouched by the transforming hand of civilization. To the keen observer, however, it was evident that we were passing through a great deal of fine country. On the other hand, it cannot be denied that part of that journey was through lands naturally barren, some desert wastes, much of which is still unreclaimed, some unreclaimable. Join me next time for more Western adventure in Crossing the Plains, Days of 57 by William Audley Maxwell, here on the Sagebrush Trail.